All right, this morning in the studio, we're glad to be joined by Paul Helko, Arrowood National Wildlife Refuge Manager. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Greg. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in or joining us here. And first time on the radio, right?
Yes, it is.
All right, well, thanks, Paul, for joining us here. And we want to talk about pollinators and pollinator plantings. So give us the details. What are pollinators?
Well, to start out, kind of take everybody back to biology class, we'll start out with pollination, you know, and that's the transfer of the pollen from the male flowers to the female flowers. Typically, you know, that takes place either through wind or water moves that pollen. That's how we produce our crops, seeds, produce. What I want to talk about today is the role of insects or pollinators in that process, and you know, what we're doing out at the refuge to help with that, and what everybody out there, you know, big and small, can do to help that process as well. Pollinators have been in the news a lot. You know, most people have been hearing about the declines in monarch butterflies. In recent years, you know, they've went from a population high of around 10 million. Some of the lows have been in the 200,000s. And, you know, another one that's gotten a lot of news is the challenges with honeybees and production there with the colony collapses. And so it's in the news, and there's a lot of things that everybody can do to help out with that.
So why are pollinators threatened?
Well, it's a combination of things. Number one, the greatest factor in it is habitat loss. Basically, these plants or these insects feed and survive off of these flowering plants. When we lose habitat conversion, or if we degrade that habitat through misuse of chemicals, we can remove those flowering plants from that. So that's the main things: habitat loss, habitat degradation, and then what happens is, it's just like us. The further we have to travel to get food or whatever, the weaker we would be. And the same things happen to those insects. So then oftentimes they'll succumb to natural causes like viruses or parasites, those kind of things.
Okay. And what can you do to help pollinators?
Well, as I said, you know, some of the reasons for the loss are chemical use. So whenever we can wisely use those chemicals, you know, follow the labels on the chemicals, they're there for a reason, you know, and that's to protect the environment, but then also control the pests. The other thing is knowing that the pests that we're trying to treat is, you know, if with crop production, we want to make sure that the pest is at a threshold that's going to cause a financial loss. We want to know that pest is there, know it's at a level that it needs to be treated. If we're treating weeds or things like that in our pastures, grazing lands, we want to spot treat as best we can. You know, at the refuge, we use basically an integrated approach where we're using cultural methods, say mowing, grazing, to treat those weeds. We'll also use chemical. We may use mowing, all those things. So a combined approach. And then that thus reduces the chemical use and doesn't kill those beneficial plants that the native pollinators need.
And how do you develop pollinator plantings?
Well, that's been really fun. It's one of the most exciting things in my job. I've been involved in some aspect of it for like 20 years, and it's really exciting how much it has advanced in North Dakota and across the nation. To start out with it, you know, anybody can do it. You can have a pollinator planting that could be in your flower bed, to the back corner of your yard, to a vacant lot in town, to, you know, wholesale fields or odd areas in your fields that may be hard to get into. So really everybody has a spot, big and small, that they can do it. The number one thing that I tell everybody, and myself included, is you have to prepare the site. You know, it's just like gardening. You have to have a good weed-free seed bed, and that takes time. On our large-scale operations, we'll typically do 4 to 5 years of site prep in a you know, in an in-town setting, something like that, I would definitely till or spray an area out for probably 2 years, so you get two full growing seasons out of it. And just because these plants, native plants, typically have very small seeds. They're tiny, tiny. The plants don't put a lot of energy into their seed production. So you want to have a real good weed-free seed bed so that those plants can get established. The other thing that's really exciting about it is when I started in native plantings and that, we didn't have a lot of available seed. At the time, you know, it was a big deal to plant 8 species, you know, both grass and forbs. Now through, you know, the expansion of the seed industry, there's all kinds of species available. You know, like a lot of our recent plantings have included like 44 species. And what we're trying to do there is if you think of anything, you know, you want to provide a food source throughout the year. So we actually structure these plantings so that they'll have cool season forbs that are flowering. Like even right now, there's species like blue flax or the crocus. You know, those are things that are going to start out right away flowering. And then as summer kicks on, there's a whole other suite of species that will start flowering. And then even into fall, you know, you'll have like your goldenrods and things like that. So we want that diversity of species so we have a food source for multiple species of insects, and then it carries them all the way through their summer and keeps them healthy. The other thing with that is, you know, there's a lot of, it's very important to get local seed sources. What we always strive is that when you're buying seed, you want to buy it from one of the surrounding states or provinces, just so it's adapted to the area. And the seed companies, we're fortunate to have lots of seed vendors in the area. Ones that we use, you know, are Agassiz Seed, Chessick Seed, Milbourne Seed. There's also smaller vendors, and then for there's actually smaller nurseries that will germinate the seeds and sell potted plants specifically, you know, for like homeowner type situations, and then that'll of course shorten the time to get your planting established. But a lot of exciting stuff. The other thing I talk to folks about is they're time savers too. You know, I in North Dakota, oftentimes we have large farmyards, you know, where we're on the mower all the time. And some of these areas in our yards never get used. We mow them week after week. I'm sure that's going to be starting here in the next few days. And some of these areas, you know, you can find a nice corner of the yard to do one of these pollinator plantings, eliminate some mowing, some wear and tear on the mower, give you some free time to get out in the boat or on the golf course, and then do some good for, you know, the insects in the neighborhood. It's a win-win. You know, a specific example right here in Carrington, the Lutheran Church had a acre and a half vacant lot that they were mowing and mowing. And, you know, you're spending that money, church resources, on mowing a lot. And one of our Birding Drives Dakota members came up with the idea to put that into a pollinator planting. So here right in Carrington, you got one of the first, and I've actually heard it's the largest like city pollinator planting in the state. So that's kind of a neat deal. And just started out last year, it was seeded. So it's going to kind of go through those growing phases. And that's one thing to remember, you know, they look messy right off the bat. The best thing you can do is kind of step back and just let the plants take over. On small scale stuff, we'll do a little bit of, you know, hand pulling of weeds. On the larger scale plantings, a lot of times we'll just do some high clipping so that the weedy species, the annual weeds, aren't competing for light and moisture, and it gives those native plants a boost. But other than that, it's really just kind of let the plants do their thing. They're strong, and they can eventually, you know, outcompete those weeds. So,
oh wow, that's pretty cool, right here in town.
Yeah.
We're talking this morning with Paul Helko, Arrowwood National Wildlife Refuge Manager. Paul, Before we went on air, we talked about Arrowwood National Wildlife, the refuge just located south of Carrington here on Highway 9. Give us maybe some details about that, because I was asking a bunch of questions, kind of trying to figure out what's all goes on down there. It's pretty cool. I mean, there's auto tours. You can hike through that, right? It's like...
That's correct. Yep. The refuge has been around for a long time. It was established in 1935. It's just shy of 16,000 acres, about 14 miles long, on the James River. It basically has four water bodies through the center of the refuge. There's Arrowwood Lake, Mud Lake, Jim Lake, and Depew Marsh. Right now and for the next month and a half is an absolutely great time to be out on the refuge with the spring migration going on. Got all kinds of waterfowl. The shorebirds are just arriving. Sharp-tailed grouse are dancing. We have blinds positioned on a grouse dancing lek that are free and open to the public. All you got to do is give a phone call, get your name on the calendar, and you show up and enjoy the grouse. The other thing I did want to mention, as far as the pollinator plantings, we've had a major endeavor on the refuge over the last 6 years, where we've been converting some of these old grasslands, not native grasslands, but old cropland that was seeded to grass. We're converting those into these pollinator plantings. And I encourage folks, if you like flowers, you want to spend a Sunday afternoon tooling around the countryside, come out to the refuge. There's right now there's five of these plantings, about 450 acres in size. A lot of them are close to the roads, and folks can come out and see these plantings in action. It's amazing to just step into them and listen to the bugs that are there. You can tell they're alive. It's just stop and listen to all the bug activity out there, and they're doing their thing. Really nice time. And the best time for seeing those flowers is, late June through August. Okay. And they'll be every colors, purples and golds and, you name it, yellows and reds. It's a pretty, pretty time to be out on the refuge. And then there's the native grasslands that are flowering as well. That's what we're trying to mimic. And lots of opportunity. As you said, the whole refuge is open to hiking, and we have about a 5-mile auto tour. Very, very nice to be out there.
And you can take Highway 9 east and then 11th Street. That's where the headquarters and everything are on too, right?
That's right. Okay. Yep. If you can either get to the refuge on 281 or Highway 9. The main road that I would recommend folks to come in on is 11th Street. That'll get you to the start of the auto tour. It'll get you to the headquarters during the week from 7 to 4. The office is open. We have a beautiful visitor center. Goes through the National Wildlife Refuge system, all the habitat management actions that we do on the refuge. People can learn about the wildlife in the state and on the refuge. It's a really beautiful, beautiful visitor center that a lot of people don't know about. I would say it's one of the nicest in the nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we were talking about some other ones before we let you go here, Paul. Sully's Hill and Devil's Lake is one too.
Right? Yep, beautiful place. Used to manage Sully's Hill. Very unique for North Dakota because it's forested. Most of the rest of our refuges are predominantly prairie. Okay. Sully's Hill also has bison and elk, which is a really cool thing to experience. Refuges, there's a refuge in every state in the nation. Refuges, other popular refuges, Long Lake, east of Bismarck, Audubon Refuge, which is halfway between Minot and Bismarck, and then you have J. Clark Salyer, which would be basically north of the town of Towner up to the Canadian border. Del Lac, and then Lostwood are in the northwestern part of the state, kind of off of from Minot. But lots of opportunity for folks in the region and across the state to get out and enjoy the National Wildlife Refuges. The other thing is we manage waterfowl production areas, and those are all across the counties, and we're doing some of these same plantings out on those WPAs too. you know, the key thing is we're focused on pollinators and the benefits to these pollinators, but these plantings themselves provide habitat and food sources for all kinds of wildlife. You know, the young birds, the young pheasants, grouse, you name it, that's what they feed on, is those insects. So if we can get these plants out there that attract and benefit the insects, provide food sources for the pheasants and grouse, grassland songbirds. And then the other thing is it's wonderful cover for nesting for those species, as well as ducks. Great cover for white-tailed deer. So it's an exciting endeavor.
All right. Awesome, Paul. Thanks so much. Great information this morning. We appreciate it. Anything else this morning you want to talk about?
Nope. Okay. Get out there and enjoy spring. All right. Hopefully it's here.
Yeah. Nicer temps today. So, yeah. All right. Thanks, Paul. We appreciate it. And have a great rest of your week in May and summer and everything. So
sounds good. You too, Greg.
All right. Yep. You bet.